enjoys. Okay, pumpkin patch.
Okay, hello everybody. Welcome to the rescheduled from October 16th, October 22nd meeting of the Clark County Commission on Aging. We'll start with an approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. And now the minutes from the September 18th meeting.
Move for approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Excellent. And then we will go straight to our presentation.
Madam Chair, one other point of order. Do we normally make motions to excuse members when they're absent? I'm wondering if we want to move to excuse Commissioner Robert.
Sure.
I'd like to make a motion to excuse Commissioner Robert from the meeting.
Do we have a second?
I'll second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Fantastic.
What's the option?
She is unexcused.
Go get a slip.
So we're very excited about our presentation for this meeting. Our speaker is Matt Herman, a transportation planner for Clark County's Community Planning Department, a position he has held since June 2014. He conducts analysis of future transportation demands, prepares capital facilities plans, and implements circulation plans to meet future needs of the growing community. Ensuring and improving Clark County's long-term quality of life, community planning is responsible for the development and administration of the county's comprehensive plan. Matt has over 13 years of professional planning and experience in Oregon and Washington. He holds an accreditation by the American Planning Association as a certified planner and certified transportation planner. He has a master's degree in sustainable transportation from UW and a bachelor's degree in urban and regional planning from Michigan State University. Please welcome Matt Herman.
Thank you very much. Thank you. First off, it's not going to offend me if you guys want to turn around and look at the screen. And I also want to acknowledge that coming from Clark County staff, the Commission on Aging is a very highly regarded committee on staff. The work that you guys do is unlike other jurisdictions, and we're very thankful to have you and have you participate in our governance. There's current staff that serves the Commission on Aging, and I'm lucky enough to be colleagues with them and get to work with them on a daily basis. So you are in good hands moving forward. So to begin, I want to start off with Clark County's identity. Clark County can be identified by growth, and that growth can be both beneficial and a detriment. It can be beneficial because it provides many options for healthcare, shopping, and recreational activities. But it can also be a detriment when it's not managed properly and it leads to sprawl, neighborhood blight, or traffic congestion. Today I'm going to take you through Clark County's growth and growth patterns and the form that it takes and how it affects our transportation behaviors. So to begin, the Commission on Aging provides the Clark County Council recommendations on improving and supporting our aging populations. I'm going to guide you through the current county processes, address modes of transportation that mostly affect our seniors, and conclude with a summary of challenges and potential areas where the COA can have meaningful input. Clark County's growth is guided by the 20-year comprehensive plan. You're familiar with this plan. The Aging Readiness Plan, which the COA was instrumental in drafting, is a supporting element of the comprehensive plan. The comprehensive plan also includes a transportation element that forecasts our future needs to support those future populations. These numbers that you see in front of you are several of our assumptions that we use to plan our future population. So to begin, this is a graph showing our population trends. Back in 1990, our population was around 225,000 people. In 2016, our population has doubled in size to approximately 470,000, and that trend continues up through our planning horizon of 2035. I'm also going to give you a glimpse of our age and sex distribution. Examining this age demographic is important for transportation planning because travel behaviors vary greatly among generations and life cycle. In 1990, the majority of our population was between 30 and 45, shown here. And the segment of population can be characterized at a time when people start making families. You can see that this is true because the increase in children in this demographic here is also consistent with the family demographic. This demographic, family age, they choose a home at this instrumental time based on their needs at that time. That needs include what's needed primarily for the children. In 2010, you can see that population has generally gotten older, yet there remains a significant amount of children in that population distribution. In 2016, Clark County has two major population sectors, 50 through 60, in this bubble. These populations tend to have a lower amount of people living under one roof compared to those ages of 30 to 50. With a lower person per household ratio in Clark County, we can conclude that we need to plan for more households with the same amount of population. Our mode choice, on the other hand, has really not changed over the course of 20 years and into the horizon. We see that the king of our transportation is the single occupancy vehicle. This commuting characteristic, as I mentioned, has really not changed. However, our time to work has changed. In 2010, if you focus on 35 minutes or more, we can see that from 2010 to 2016, this has increased dramatically, while 10 to 14 minutes has decreased. This can suggest a couple things. Number one, commuters may be living further from work, or two, workers may be slowed by a traffic congestion.
Matt, do you want to take questions as you go, or want to hold them until the end?
Why don't we hold it to the end, because some of the slides back up what I mentioned. And we can, as questions go on, we can move through the slides. So how does Clark County grow? Right here you're seeing the Clark County boundary along with several of its rivers and streams. Here is Clark County with its seven cities, Battleground here, Camas, Le Center, Ridgefield, Vancouver, Washougal, and a small, tiny section of Woodland. We also have the town of Yakult. Each one of these cities has an urban growth area. The urban growth area is where each city plans on growing in the next 20 years. Now, as I move through this presentation, I want to clarify my role. Often when people speak of Clark County, we speak of Clark County as a whole. However, my department and the Department of Public Works only has jurisdiction in the unincorporated Clark County area. This is the area of gray and white. Roads within the cities are the sole responsibilities of those cities. The Vancouver urban growth area is the largest in the county. In 2010, the population of Vancouver was 183,000 people. This ranked as the fourth largest city in the state. In 2010, the population of the Vancouver urban growth area was 133,000. If this were to be a city, it would have ranked as the fifth largest in the state. So as you can see, planning for Clark County's future transportation is planning for an urban environment. Now, as I go through my presentation, I'm going to go through this cycle of transportation and land use. This is a little difficult to see. The text is a little bit difficult to see. But the first cycle, part of the cycle that we're going to dive into is when land is developed. So right now you're looking at the original survey for downtown Vancouver. This was approved and developed back in 1852. You can notice that the town was originally laid out in a grid pattern, streets running east-west and north-south. This was allowed and built for the pedestrian environment. It provided order to the pedestrians. It also provided, at the time, safeguarding the city against overcrowding, fires, as well as disease. You'll notice that the streets in this original survey have the same width, whether they run north and south and east and west. They all have uniform street width. This street width, if this grid were to be built today, would have a high cost because of the amount of infrastructure necessary to build those wide streets. Today, you can see how that grid network forms downtown Vancouver. Downtown Vancouver, with this grid pattern, has been very adaptable. Some streets have disappeared as blocks have merged together. The interstate construction was planned to follow the eastern edge of that original survey, down here. And roundabouts, particularly the one at the southwestern corner of Esther Short Park, was built within the existing right-of-way. As Vancouver develops its south waterfront, you can see that that grid pattern has continued to be adaptable, providing the flexibility to link the new neighborhood to downtown. This is a survey of residential suburban development that was approved by Clark County in 1968. This suburban development is located in the Truman neighborhood. It is north of SR 500, east of St. John's Road, and south of 44th Street. You can see with this survey that grid pattern still exists, north, south, east, west. At the time in 1968, and I apologize because the photograph here is a little grainy, but you can see that the development is built further away from the services in the downtown core. As post-war suburban communities began to flourish as late as the 1960s, the automobile continued to be king. No services, businesses, or employment were located near or adjacent to the neighborhood. Homes were built in the immediate access to the automobile and to the street. The right-of-way was built only to serve cars. Pedestrians and buses were absent. As residential development continued into 1974, Truman Elementary, shown here, was built to serve the students in the growing neighborhood. Yet no sidewalks were built when the survey was originally approved, and sidewalks were not required to be built. That grid pattern, although, remained a core network. Today, in 2016, you can see that neighborhood still remains largely vacant of sidewalks. Although, due to a federal initiative that required students to have safe access to school, a sidewalk was built along 44th Street that had access to Truman Elementary School. This sidewalk was built by purchasing enough land in the right-of-way to accommodate the sidewalk. Retrofitting this existing neighborhood with sidewalks that currently do not exist is a very difficult task, not only financially to accommodate the right-of-way, but logistically as well. In order to obtain the space for sidewalks, the county would have to acquire right-of-way from each of the residential developments, or take away the on-street parking to build the sidewalk in the existing street. So why are these growth patterns different? Well, in the post-war era, the GI Bill provided low-cost mortgages to obtain that American dream, allow everyone the opportunity to purchase a home. And we learned how to build houses at an exceptional rate with the advent. There was also the advent of the interstate system. The interstate system provided access to new land for residential development, and that interstate system did not increase the time that it took people to get to work because they had easy access onto a fast-moving thoroughfare. Now we're going to fast forward to 1989. This is a subdivision that was approved at that time, located south of Northwest 139th Street, west of Skyview High School. The Salmon Creek Greenway, if you're familiar, is along right here. And you can see that that grid network, north, south, east, west, has been replaced by cul-de-sacs. Cul-de-sacs did allow for the maximization of the land for residential development. In other words, we learned how to accommodate more lots on the same amount of land while still meeting consumer demands. You can see from this picture, in 1994, the subdivision was built, and sidewalks were required to be built on both sides of the street. Sidewalks, you can see in this photograph, are shown as a light, almost white marking on the street. But in 1994, there were still no immediate services in adjacent to this residential development. Today, however, Chinook Elementary School is a short distance away from this subdivision. So children living in this neighborhood, if they lived there when the subdivision was initially built, they took their bus to school because the school was further away. In 2016, today, because they're within less than 1 mile from school, no buses serve that neighborhood. They would be required to walk or be driven by their parents. So a student that only lives a short distance as the crow flies from Chinook Elementary School now has to take a serpentine route to get to school. So next I'm going to talk about the increased amount of traffic that occurs. This map here is showing the capacity of Clark County streets. Capacity is the total amount of volume that streets are designed to accommodate. A thicker and deeper shade of blue shows a greater capacity. Obviously, I-5 and 205, I-5 running north, 205, have the greatest capacity in the region, with the state highways to follow. SR 500, see here, as well as SR 14 running east-west. High capacity streets that fall under county's jurisdiction include sections of Patton Parkway, shown here, 78th Street, sections of 99th Street, St. John's Road, 72nd Avenue, and now the newly complete 119th Street. In this slide, I'm displaying the actual volumes of traffic on the street network. We measure volumes during the peak period. Oftentimes, this is referred to by another term, PM peak. Laymen may know this as rush hour. So you can see our heaviest volumes in the PM peak period are 205s, both northbound and southbound. As traffic increases, we have a deterioration of service that don't meet our citizens' demands. We measure that deterioration through a volume-to-capacity ratio. This ratio compares the amount of volume in the peak period with the capacity that that street is designed to accommodate. When a street has volumes of 90% of the capacity that they are designed to accommodate, they're considered failing. Here you can see sections that are expected to fail when we plan for our future populations. This map is a future forecast of the 2035 volume capacity ratio with the expected population and traffic added into it. So you can see in 2035, we're showing potential failure along 72nd Avenue from 119th Street North. This 119th Street, there's currently a project that's proposing to alleviate the need for expansion in that section. We also have a significant amount of needs in East Vancouver urban growth area, most notably the Orchards area, where we're seeing that the streets that are in place now can't accommodate the future populations along Ward Road, north of 88th Street, 152nd Avenue, as well as, I believe this is 94th Avenue. For those that live in Phillida, we have a congestion problem along Lakeshore Drive that goes into to the north, all the way to Bliss Road. As our transportation facilities fail, there's demand for street improvements to reduce that congestion. These improvements may be in the form of street widenings, new streets, or operational corrections. However, in our 20-year financial forecast, we're showing a $158 million deficit, meaning we don't have all of the money to fix the improvements that are necessary to accommodate the future populations. On the left column are charts showing our revenues through the next 20 years, and on the right are our expenses. The largest road expense on an annual basis is the county's road preservation program. This is a program that's dedicated to maintain the existing current conditions of the existing street system. After the county maintains the current system, it makes improvements to the major streets. Street improvements are slated for improvement and are prioritized based on these criteria. Criteria that you see here are approved by Clark County Council. Safety has always been paramount in our prioritization scale. Improvements oftentimes receive ranking in all of these categories, not just a single category. A recent example of a major improvement is the upgrade to Northeast 119th Street. This is a major road running east-west that was initially built as a rural country road. From this picture, you're looking eastward at approximately the Thornton Tree Farm just east of 72nd Avenue. This is the condition before the improvements, and here are the improvements after. The street has been widened to two lanes in both directions, two lanes in each direction, four lanes total, with a center turn lane, bike lanes, and sidewalks. The total cost for this project was $23.5 million and was approximately 3/4 of a mile long. The cycle continues following arterial improvements, leading to increased accessibility, land availability, and ultimately changes in land use. We've experienced that once road expansion occurs, it allows more access to that urban development. So primarily up to now I've focused around vehicular transportation, but now I want to examine the county's land use patterns in relation to access to transit. We'll focus around accessible transit and how it differs from neighborhood to neighborhood. Please also keep in mind that transit accommodates all ages, children that cannot drive, and seniors that feel safer riding a bus. Here you're seeing a traditional historic neighborhood with its grid pattern and a suburban neighborhood with its curvilinear streets and cul-de-sacs. Bus stops, are shown as purple dots. They're hard to see, probably easier to see on your handout. And transit lines are shown in green. These neighborhoods, currently you're right here. This is the Hauk neighborhood with Hauk Elementary School located right there. This is Hazeldell neighborhood, 99th Street, and Geyser Middle School right there. So the neighborhood on the left, the blue circle in this map, on these maps, are showing the traditional catchment area for transit and the bus stop. The catchment area is a quarter-mile buffer that the transit agencies typically use to forecast potential users of the system. Many studies have shown that the amount of bus riders dramatically drop off outside of that quarter-mile buffer area. And this buffer area is shown as the crow flies. So from the bus stop to the edge of the buffer area is a direct distance as the crow flies. So obviously our citizens can't fly, so here you're seeing the actual quarter mile in walking distance in pink. You can see how these two different neighborhoods respond very differently with transit. On the left, the grid pattern provides much more accessibility to transit than the suburban residential neighborhood. In the suburban residential neighborhood, even a residence that is immediately in the vicinity of the bus stop still is with outside the quarter mile walking distance. Fortunately for this neighborhood was required to build a pedestrian easement that connected the cul-de-sac to the bus stop. You can see on this map how that pedestrian easement has enlarged the catchment and the accessibility to transit for a large amount of that neighborhood. However, we have developments that are adjacent to bus lines that were approved prior to the bus stop being in place. This area is along 99th Street, just east of SR 503, running here. And is in the Orchards neighborhood. You can see that there are several residential lots in this cul-de-sac here that are in the immediate vicinity of a bus stop but are outside that quarter-mile walking distance. Even in this neighborhood here, we have residences that can see the bus stop from the rear window, but in order to access the bus stop, they have to walk a lot further than one quarter mile. So again, I want to reiterate that the development wasn't required to make pedestrian connections to the bus stop because those bus stops weren't in place at the time the development was approved. In order to plan for future conditions, cul-de-sacs that are within a certain distance to collectors and arterials of which transit is usually located should be required to provide pedestrian easements to the street even when the bus stop is not present at the time of approval. This map is showing West Hazeldell neighborhood. Our streets are classified based on a hierarchy. Local streets, shown in black. Collectors, shown in green. And arterials, 78th Street, 99th Street, and Hazeldale Avenue are arterials. Arterials, or local roads, connect the residential areas to collectors, connecting them to arterials, which is mainly where our commercial businesses or our main hospitals or services are located. And those arterials connect to our interstate system. I want to go back to this. Even though this system is built for automobiles, every mode of transportation has to use this system of streets. So for an example, here's a two-lane collector, Northeast 88th Street. It has a center turn lane throughout, one lane in each direction, bike lanes, and sidewalks on both sides of the street. The typical posted speed for a collector is around 30 miles per hour. Here's a minor arterial, Northeast 99th Street. Again, center turn lane is required, and one lane in each direction, bike lanes, and sidewalks. A typical minor arterial is posted at 35 miles per hour. Here's 78th Street. It's a principal arterial with four lanes, two in each direction. Again, that center turn lane, bike lanes, and sidewalks. Speed on a principal arterial is around 45 miles per hour. Another example of a street that we have in rural Clark County are our major collectors. This is built as a typical country road, two lanes, one in each direction, no bike lanes, no sidewalks, really no shoulder. So the table here shows the required width for sidewalks. 5 feet on a local road, 6 feet on a collector, 6 to 8 feet on a commercial industrial road that serves industrial development, and 6 feet on an arterial. Total sidewalk width you can see in this column. But while our sidewalk widths don't increase, our roadway widths do increase to accommodate that greater speed. Now, this is not necessarily a county deficiency, the reason why the structure is like this, but one that is borne by the state. Several granting agencies restrict design that are excessive than those that are approved in the state manual. So if Clark County wanted to build a sidewalk that's greater than 5 feet, the money of that sidewalk more than 5 feet would have to be paid through the taxpayers. This puts more pressure on the county to fund projects that are needed to accommodate the growth. Here I'm showing two examples of the differences between attached and detached sidewalks. Both of these streets are principal arterials that connect commercial uses to SR 14 on the east side of Clark County. 164th here, you're seeing an attached sidewalk to the street and a detached sidewalk with a green buffer between the street and the sidewalk on 192nd Avenue. The detached sidewalk obviously provides a safer environment for pedestrians to walk, and it buffers them from the 40 mile per hour traffic. If sidewalks use the same hierarchy as streets, we can see where pedestrians are more likely to go. Clark County has an annual sidewalk program. That program constructs small infill or gap projects. Again, safety is the primary scoring criterion for this program. This program is very small in comparison to other programs in the county, approximately only $100,000 a year is allocated to the sidewalk, the ongoing sidewalk program. So Clark County is making changes to accommodate pedestrians. We're retrofitting our push buttons, you can see here, to be more accessible for ADA compliant. Push buttons are at the height where a wheelchair can access them. They also have, they emit a chirp that allows sight impaired folks to safely cross the street. This encourages more of a pedestrian environment than our traditional, our mobile centric. New technology is also being implemented by Clark County. South of 78th Street on Highway 99, this is a pedestrian refuge. Fred Meyer is directly to, it'd be to the left of this picture. Near Fred Meyer, there's also a transit stop. This refuge utilizes infrared detection. There's a camera mounted at a pole here that detects infrared or heat from a pedestrian and automatically tells the motorist to stop because there's a pedestrian that needs to cross. The detection device helps to assure pedestrians that they will be safe when crossing to Fred Meyer and ultimately encourages more trips through walking. Earlier this year, Gary Albrecht from Clark County Community Planning talked to you about how we are amending our comprehensive plan to include a complete streets policy that accommodates multiple forms of transportation. We're also implementing strategies that are beneficial to pedestrians, most notably the Green Streets Program. Is a program that's housed in our what used to be environmental services area, now under public works, that infiltrates the stormwater runoff from the road into bioretention or plants that help filter that runoff and drain into underground. These Green Streets programs help to accommodate that buffer from the street for pedestrians. We're also doing neighborhood level planning. You may be familiar with the Highway 99 plan. This Highway 99 plan accommodates trails and sections that safely access residential development along Hazeldale neighborhood to Highway 99 safely and conveniently. Highway 99 subarea plan. So with that, I'm open to.
Okay, thank you, Matt. First, we'll do questions from the commission. Marion?
Matt, your pictures of the historic development of the grid system in the city and the cul-de-sacs in the county, really interesting. But I'm wondering now, do we require sidewalks for new residential development in the county?
So sidewalks are required on both sides of the street when new development is approved. It's a condition inside the urban area and inside the rural centers of Clark County. Rural centers, when I say rural centers, I'm referring to areas like Brush Prairie, Dollar's Corner, and Hawkinson. They are required on both.
And they would be detached or attached or any way they want?
They can be detached and attached. If they are detached, they are allowed to be smaller than the 5 feet.
What about gutters and curbs?
They are required in urban Clark County.
Very good.
Larry?
Two questions. First is requirements by the county for street lighting.
Yeah, there are none. Street lighting is required inside the city, but not in unincorporated Clark County.
Not in critical road intersections or anything like that?
Where safety is an issue at major intersections, it's provided in locations. Rob, am I but it's not a requirement for development to occur.
And the other question is, one of my animal friends asked me, are there any designated areas that are habitually animals have a certain crossing culverts or something to go underneath to protect? You do have a requirement for that?
When it comes to salmon, we do.
Okay.
When it comes to residential pets or deer or elk,
they're on their own.
Chuck?
Thank you. First, I'm a Michigan Wolverine, so sorry about the football game on Saturday.
Right now, really.
You showed a graphic showing travel time to work, and I'm just curious while you're finding that. What was the source for that graph?
So the source of this came out during the 2010 was with the U.S. Census. 2016 was the American Community Survey.
Okay, so this was like journey to work data, so it would include Clark County residents that travel into Portland.
Correct.
For yeah. work.
It doesn't only contain Clark County employers. It's Clark County residents going to wherever they work, whether it be Calhoun County or Multnomah County.
So 2010 was right at about the start of coming out of the recession. And so I know there was a reduction in I-5 traffic during the recession. We've managed to catch up and go beyond that now. So how much of this, the increase in travel time between 2010 and 2016, would you estimate is due to coming out of the recession versus growth that would have driven that?
Yeah, I think in 2010 there was a higher amount of unemployment than there is today. I think that definitely adds to the data. But as we did initially provide you 2000 data on this, but in order to hone in at the changes, we only wanted to provide 2010 to 2016 to show how it's being affected in the comprehensive plan.
So you would say that growth does have a big part in that an increase?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Amy?
First, I want to thank you for the presentation. I'm so glad there's somebody who understands the streets that I drive as well as you do. I'm looking at the page of Northeast 10th Avenue, and you said there's no shoulder and no bike lane. What is that area on the outside?
Bear with me as I go to that.
It's not too far from the end.
We're getting them all over the place.
So this is Northeast 10th Avenue. I believe this is maybe
G Creek.
Yeah, north of Whipple Creek. So on the shoulder here, you're showing just basically a drainage ditch here, and then there is a stream that runs under this section of bridge.
So the area from the white line to the vegetation is called what?
It's just a shoulder.
It is a shoulder.
It's not a bike lane. It's a shoulder. Bikes can locate on this street. They can ride on this street, but it is technically not a bike lane.
Okay. And I'm also interested in where you were talking about the height of the buttons.
Yes.
Is there a standard number of seconds that someone has to cross, and is it related to disabled or elderly people?
My apologies, but I'm going to have to defer to my public works expert. If yeah. Mm. Rob Klug, Rob.
Who has traffic signals?
I am Rob Klug. I'm the traffic signals manager for Clark County Public Works. We have a standard that we use for the timing of the walk and the flash and don't walk. There is no hard and fast standard that says this is the way it must be done. What we do is we base the walk time on between 5 and 7 seconds. In some cases, we go a little longer than that, based upon the number of pedestrians we typically see at a location. And then the flashing don't walk time is longer for Clark County traffic signals than you'll find for many other traffic signals in the area, because we time the flashing don't walk for a person who's walking 3 feet per second from the time they step into the roadway at the curb return until they step into the roadway and the other curb return. So you take the distance between the two pieces of concrete cement on the return and divide that by three, and that should be the number of seconds you see per feet per second. We do it differently than other agencies do. We tend to be a little more we're a little, what's the right word? I'm sorry, I'm having absolute mind blank here.
You're good.
Conservative. We're being a little more conservative in how we actually time the timings.
Is there data research that says disabled people must have this many seconds or this many feet per second?
The Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices is a federal document that the states actually write into black letter law. And so it's a book about that thick that is really, really good if you have trouble sleeping at night. Really good for that. But they recommend 4 feet per second. And if you have people that have other needs, to go down to 3 feet per second. We don't know who's out there. So rather than taking a chance and going 4 feet per second and saying, hey, you're on your own, we just turn around and make it 3 feet per second.
Is there a history of accidents or problems with that?
No. Now, the flip side of that is what that does do is that does significantly affect the ability to progress traffic. So when you have pedestrians crossing at a major intersection, it can put the signal so it's starting its coordination phase 10, 15, 20 seconds later than it should. It's part of the balance that we have to find with safety and mobility. We're always going to pick safety first and then try to find the best way to have the mobility we can.
Thank you.
Marjorie? Are pedestrian easements and cul-de-sacs required in the county?
Only when a bus stop is in the immediate vicinity.
And so I just wanted to tag, I had a clarifying question too. You'd mentioned the easements and cul-de-sacs, and so you're making the recommendation that for future planning, it would be good to have those easements even if the bus stop doesn't already exist.
Thanks for clarifying.
Okay.
And it's a bus stop like C-Tran versus school bus stop.
Correct. Yeah. When I say bus stop, I'm talking strictly C-Tran.
Linda.
What, great presentation. Really informative. What role does accidents play in this? We didn't talk about that specifically, and especially bike on these beautiful country roads we have that have no easement. We saw
Yeah, bikes are, safety is always going to be our paramount responsibility to the residents to provide safe infrastructure. So when we evaluate safety concerns, it's based on a historic collision accident rate. When we look at locations where bikers may be involved in accidents in the rural area, if we see a trend, we help to alleviate that trend through some mechanism that either is signage that alerts motorists to bike routes that or designated, but it's not a bike lane, but a bike route that they may be traveling on.
Larry?
One other question. You may have mentioned it, Matt, in your presentation. Is any of the signage change as far as the size and whether they're street signs or safety signs, have they changed over the period of time? Or
yeah, actually they're going through a change right now. Residential streets are a yellow sign right now, where they are switching to leaf green sign. That's black and white.
But they're not reflective.
They are reflective.
Are reflective, yeah. So you move into that direction. Always been, okay.
What we're doing is we're moving from the standard used to be the least possible reflective type of sign to one that actually has the reflective to be able to see it better at night.
Okay.
There's a whole science behind how you decide what type of shape material to go on.
Okay. size of the lettering is changing as well?
I believe there was a small change. I know that Federal Highways made a change in the font. I wouldn't be able to tell the difference, but it was a change federally.
Amy?
I don't know how much responsibility you had for it, but thank you to you or someone for 119th Street.
In the county, when you work with the county, it's purely a team effort. It's not just one person.
This is your chance to take all the credit in front of your colleagues. Any other questions from the commission? Chuck?
I want to follow up on the requirement versus encouraging the walkway from a cul-de-sac to the street. You said right now the county code requires that for when there's a C-Tran.
Yeah, when there's a C-Tran bus stop and a new development is located in immediate vicinity of that bus stop, we require a pedestrian easement from the developer.
So if there is not a current C-Tran route, but C-Tran might have a plan for a future route, does that still apply, or is that case by case?
I think that's part of my recommendation is if it's along a collector or arterial that the subdivision is adjacent to, that pedestrian easement be automatically built in even if a bus stop doesn't exist.
Okay, so that is something that's not currently in code, but is there a process, like we're in the process of writing our annual report, and that is due to be presented to the county council in January. Would your update process allow for us to make that recommendation?
Absolutely. What we could do is, through coordination with C-Tran, we could take your future transit routes and have those on hand when a development comes in that is immediate to that adjacent future transit route that that pedestrian easement can be accommodated. But that future plan, when it's adopted, helps us have teeth to make that requirement.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions from the community? Want to come up to the mic? Thank you.
I'm primarily here. I'm interested in 68th Street. Is it a collector or is it an arterial?
68th Street.
It's in between 78th and Minnehaha.
I believe it's a collector.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. I'm the advocate for getting sidewalks on 68th Street. And one, I really want to make sure that the public is involved before the plan. Your ideas, like planning ahead of time, but I really think we could save a lot of money if we would recommend doing infill to transit and working together. I live in right across near Hazeldale Park and across from the farm. Mm-hmm. If we worked with the City of Vancouver and Clark County, that would help our funding tremendously for sidewalks. Mm-hmm. And I'm not seeing that yet, despite my proactive.
Yeah. As I kind of mentioned in the previous presentation, the problem was when the subdivision was initially approved without sidewalks. Retrofitting it is very difficult mm-hmm. and an added expense.
Right.
So whether that expense is borne by the Clark County taxpayers or by the neighborhood, it could be two different.
Well, 68th Street's already been approved for.
Yeah. If it's a collector, generally it would have the sidewalks, but the local roads.
Oh, I understand that. Bud Van Cleve fought for sidewalks for 50 years, so we've been fighting for a long time, and it's very close. And lots of people walk on a slide-impaired hill. So my question, how did the county decide to lower the speed limit? Because we've been agitating to lower the speed limit. The Washington Transportation Safety Committee really recommends 25 miles per hour. So if the county is really sincere about safety, they really need to look at streets that are how you increase walkability is to lower. And then those flashing signs like the city has, mm-hmm. do they work that shows your speed limit?
So let me answer the first question. Mm-hmm. Speed, when speeds are adjusted, there's a survey that takes place through our Public Works Department where they go on the street and actually categorize how fast the cars are traveling. And that is adjusted whether it's increased or decreased based on their survey at the time. The second point that you made was in regard to,
Like so many things.
The flashing lights and the flashing signs initially work, but over time motorists get used to it and travel the speed at which they want to travel.
The walkability is really, really low in the whole Azledale area, and it was a country road. It's really not a country road now, and I just saw that we're going to have trails hopefully be part of the parks plan, so then we can connect. So if you really want to help the frail elderly and the elderly walk and increase their walkability, we really have to connect some of those trails.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And so thank you for what you do. But, yeah, planning, if we could work together and plan, like what you talked about with the cul-de-sac and the easement, that's what we really need to see starting more of that.
Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you. Anyone else? All right. Last call. Thank you, Matt. This was a great presentation. And let's see. So next month, on November 13th, we will be hearing about emerging technologies with our guest speaker, Becky Steckler. Advances in emerging technologies from autonomous vehicles to e-commerce and the sharing economy are having profound effects not only on how we live, move, and spend our time in cities, but also on urban form and development itself. We will hear more about these technologies and the implications for layout of communities and the places we spend our time. Becky Steckler is the program manager for Urbanism Next at the University of Oregon, and she will discuss emerging technologies and how the impacts on our communities will change how people young and old move around. And now it is time for public comment. Come on up.
Hello. So Marjorie stopped by my shop the other day and said that I should come down and tell you guys what we do and what we have to offer for the aging population. My number one buyer is an aging mother-in-law.
Can you tell us who you are and what your business is?
Derek Hugel with Wolf Industries, Inc. We manufacture and build small, legal, permittable structures used as ADUs, guest houses, or mother-in-law cottages. So, yeah, we've got many of them placed in Clark County, Portland, all over. So I brought some, basically, flyers just to hand out and then maybe answer a couple of your questions. And that's
excellent. Well, yeah.
Are you regional?
Yes.
Okay.
We shipped a house to Utah.
Is there an article about you in the paper recently?
Yeah.
So we're looking at a flyer for your Model C.
Yep.
So these are designed to fit within ADU standards?
Yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it's 413 square feet. Most of the time that's not going to exceed 40% of the primary dwelling. I saw that we have our planner back here, so he knows all about what we got going on.
So I'm also on the Community Roots Stakeholder Group, and that group is looking at building a cottage home or tiny home community somewhere in Vancouver or Clark County. Do these comply with, for example, City of Vancouver?
Yes.
For tiny homes?
So yep. So they're not, if we use the word tiny home inside this building, they look at you sideways. But these are small modular structures built to the state housing code. So we have gold label inspectors coming down from Olympia through LNI, their factory assembled structure program. So every step of the way it's inspected in our shop. So then when it gets on site, all that gets inspected is the connection from the foundation to the structure itself.
Are they on a slab then? They'd meet the...
No, stem wall foundation, not a slab. Oh, you could technically put a slab underneath it, but the house actually does not sit on a slab.
And I noticed there's stairs coming into the front door in this one. Do you build them so they're accessible?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because that's what I was saying earlier. Our aging population is my number, emerging and aging. But generally, it's the aging that wants to move in with their daughter or son or, you know, something like that. So Clark County already has a great option with the hardship affidavit that you fill out, and they allow us to use these as a hardship dwelling.
Do you have any of these that have been placed in Clark County?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what I'm saying, lots of them. I've been doing this, and I didn't even think to come visit with you guys, and Marjorie came and found me, so I said, yeah, I can come down there and talk to you guys.
So would we find locations on your website if we want to point some of our realtor friends to them?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can come out to Battleground and check us out at the shop, where I can give you places to kind of drive by and look over and see at some of them, yeah.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
What are the ranges and size usually?
So I go 10 by 30, which is a 300. I have a 10 by 40, that's 400. And then I have a 14 by 44, which is 616. So I got three sizes.
Okay, great.
And you pick the flavor. What's that?
Are they all one bedroom?
No, the big one is two bedroom, one bath, yeah.
Are these built on a foundation, did you say?
They go on a permanent foundation, correct.
Foundation.
Now, permanent can then be relatively easily removed, because, again, with the hardship situation, after the hardship ceases to exist, you have to remove the house within 2 months. So, but because they're small, they're easy to get underneath and lift up and move on to the next. Any other questions?
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
I'll let you out.
All right. Anybody else? Okay, well then we are adjourned. Thank you very much for coming.
Yep.
Matt, nice job.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I need steroids for the asthma. Just coming off a cold. But.